Hello.
Hey,
how's everybody today?
I'm doing well. Phil,
good.
How are you?
Hey, Bill, can you stay on afterwards? I got a question about the T-32. I need to ask you.
About public access?
No, about an appointment.
Okay, that's fine.
Just get your idea. It wouldn't take just a couple minutes.
That's fine. Yeah, I think we're going to have the data call, but I think we're rescheduling that.
Yeah,
that was
another question too. I guess Tatiana's schedule is kind of tight.
Yep.
And I guess Sarah can address it, but I don't know if she's on yet. But I don't know how much longer we should wait. So.
Well, I think having Tatiana on there would be a good thing. So.
Me too, but if she can't do it,
I think it's okay.
You can wait a month.
It's hard to pin down, right?
Yeah, but, I mean, it may be a month.
Oh.
So,
well,
Sarah knows more than I do. Sarah knows more than I do, so she'll be on. And
okay.
She just signed on to the WebEx, so. All right. Is Dale there as well?
Not yet, but he will be joining us. Yeah.
Okay. Jennifer, you're there? Kazoo? Olivia Weeks is there? I guess nobody's here.
Sarah's here.
Sarah's there. All right. Anyone else on?
Hi, this is Mohan Suri.
Oh, hi. How are you?
Hi, good. How are you?
This is Sarah Jo. I'm just having a little
trouble. Oh, Sarah Jo, you made it.
I made it. Yes, indeed. And my bag and everything. Amazing.
So where are you? Are you in Atlanta or Gainesville?
I am back in Gainesville.
Wow. All right. Michael, you on? Jennifer. Christy Petranko.
Yes.
Is Christiana there?
No, he's stuck in a conference.
Okay. Claire? Joanne, Jeff, Johan.
Yep, here.
I'm sorry. Who is that?
That was Johan.
Okay. Scott, Ted Jones, Tina Chambers, Tatiana, Peter. Tom Blanchard?
Yes.
Kazoo?
Yes.
Bill Barnett?
I'm here.
Tom Donaldson?
Hi, Ed.
John
hey,
Hannigan?
Dale. Dale, too.
Hey, Dale.
This is
Hannigan's here. Hannigan's here.
Savage? Helen?
Hey, it's me.
Okay.
Hey, Ed, it's Michael. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Very well, thank you.
Good morning, Ed.
All right, so Jennifer?
Yep.
Okay. Claire Coles, Joanne Weinberg, Jeff?
Here.
Jeff
Joanne is here.
I got that. Scott?
Here.
Ken Jones or Tina Chambers? Okay, well, we have a rather full... Olivia, are you there?
Yes, we're here.
Okay, good. We have a pretty full agenda today. And so I'm going to turn this over to Michael, who may want to give an introduction to Olivia Weeks, which starting with her presentation. She's a PhD candidate at Harvard Medical School, and she is going to be presenting at the International Conference in Vancouver in April. So, Michael, do you have any introduction?
You've done most of it, but I'll just mention that she is working in the laboratory of Dr. Wolfram Gosling, who's located at...
I'm here, too.
Oh, great. Hi, Wolfram. How are you?
Thanks for joining.
And we thought that this would be a very interesting project for people in CPAS to hear about because it aligns with the theme of developmental origins of health and disease and the effects of prenatal alcohol exposure on longstanding changes in human physiology. And their work is in zebrafish, which also aligns with what Johan does. So we thought that some of her exciting results would be known to CPAS and invite discussion afterwards. So go ahead, Olivia.
Okay, fabulous. First, just thank you so much for having us today. We are very new to this field, so it's an honor to be able to share our work with you guys.
Could somebody put their phone on mute? I'm sorry.
I don't think so.
It might not be you. It might be somebody else. Yeah, not you. We don't want you on mute.
We're hearing a lot of background noise.
Thank you.
We can't have the speaker on mute, but if everyone else can mute, that would be great. Okay.
All right.
All right.
Can everyone
ready?
Hear us?
Yep.
All right, perfect. So what we're really interested in the Gosling Laboratory is understanding developmental origins of adult disease, and we're particularly interested in connections between fetal alcohol exposure and chronic health outcomes like obesity and metabolic syndrome. And sorry, we're having a technical difficulty with our slides. So our laboratory uses the zebrafish as a model for FASD, and this is something that Johan Eberhardt and others have pioneered in the field. Essentially, the zebrafish are ideal because we can submerge the embryos in ethanol water during key developmental periods and recapitulate a number of the key features of the human fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, so things like short stature, cardiac defects, craniofacial malformations. And we've described a number of things, including altered kidney formation, disrupted hepatic maturation, and things that have been described in the rodent literature. And so this is just a picture to show you what our zebrafish larvae look like. The top picture is a normal larvae, and the bottom two pictures are larvae that have been exposed to alcohol, and you can see cardiac edema and craniofacial anomalies and altered eye development, among other things. As I mentioned, we're really interested in the underappreciated implications for fetal alcohol exposure on long-term outcomes, and particularly what happens to animals with fetal alcohol exposure when they actually grow up. And so, you know, it's something we've talked about with Dr. Charness a lot, but the field sort of faces this black hole problem, in part because of confounding socioeconomic factors where we're not currently able to very clearly connect prenatal alcohol exposure with certain adult health output. So we'd like to use the zebrafish model to start to get at this question. So the first goal of our project is to really understand the output associated with prenatal alcohol exposure, and we're focusing on obesity and diabetes. And then the second goal is to really describe the mechanisms that are responsible for altered disease risk. And so we're interested in metabolic changes, transcriptional changes, alterations in chronic stress response that can cause susceptibility to these phenotypes. So the first thing that we've done is generated a zebrafish population that has prior fetal alcohol exposure. And so we use a number of genetically distinct families in our studies, and we essentially mate individual family members. We then raise embryos that we either expose to zero or various concentrations of ethanol exposure that we sort of modeled after Johan's work. And then we grow those fish up to larval or adult stages, and we've developed a dietary challenge where we can give them a regular diet or a high-fat diet in order to assess susceptibility to obesity.
Olivia, sorry to interrupt you, but so are these families, are these mutagenized families or just different genetic backgrounds? Or?
Yeah, so these are genetically distinct AB lines. So we're not mating any siblings of one another. They're all novel matings, and they're not mutagenized at all, but we keep track of the families so that we know we can compare the impact in different family backgrounds.
Thank you.
And so you could imagine the type of screen where in the future you could design a number of experiments where you look at susceptibility in specific families and do genetic sequencing to look at what genes might be causing these different susceptibilities. So that's something we're interested in but not currently pursuing. So the first question we really wanted to ask is whether or not fetal alcohol exposure is a risk factor for diet-induced obesity in larvae. And there's some epidemiological studies in the field circulating around that suggest a higher incidence of obesity in FASD children. And so we saw a very similar thing in our zebrafish. So when we challenged our fish with a high-fat, high-cholesterol diet, the fetal alcohol exposed fish developed increased visceral adiposity. So this is an example of Nile red staining, which is a lipophilic stain that binds to the fat in adipocytes. You can see that sort of beautiful red pancreatic fat depot, and it's significantly enlarged in our zebrafish in a number of genetically distinct backgrounds. So it doesn't seem family specific, but it seems to penetrate regardless of parental origin. Under normal diet conditions, we don't see this phenotype, so the propensity towards larval obesity seems to be specific to a high-fat, high-cholesterol diet challenge and really dependent on this dietary stressor. And next, we were very interested in whether this susceptibility for diet-induced obesity persisted through adulthood. And the answer is that yes, it did, but only in males and not in females. So when we gave the high-fat, high-cholesterol diet challenge, the fetal alcohol-exposed fish developed an enlarged abdomen, which you can see in the photograph there. And they had a significant increase in total body mass index, which is essentially just a measure of the length versus weight ratio in the fish. And under normal diet conditions, just like in the larvae, there were no significant differences in BMI. Perhaps at younger ages and even just under regular normal diet conditions, the fetal alcohol exposed fish might actually be a little bit smaller on average than the control. So actually the phenotypes that we're seeing with the diet-induced obesity are perhaps surprising given that sort of background.
I have a question. This is Jennifer. What about their food intake? Was that different, or how does that compare?
So we do this pellet feeding assay where we can count the number of pellets that fish eat over a 10 to 20 day period, and we didn't see any differences in the number of pellets consumed. And we did a number of behavioral studies to look at total activity of the fish. They seem to be more anxious, but they don't seem to spend any less time swimming, so we don't think that a reduction in activity is responsible for the weight gain or the food intake either.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Olivia, have you ever looked at the livers of these fish?
Yeah, so they progress really rapidly towards non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. And they also have hepatic stellate cell infiltration, so there seems to be some sort of inflammatory response also. We're not going to show that stuff today, but...
Is that only on the high-fat diet?
Yes, so we only see histologic differences on the high-fat diet. We don't see anything under normal diet, although we have done RNA-seq on the livers, and we have found transcriptional changes that are innate, a baseline in the livers, and so I'm going to talk a little bit about that briefly, but I think that they are metabolically distinct and transcriptionally distinct even before we give the diet challenge, and so that might be predisposing them to altered utilization of nutrients, things like that. All right. So we wanted to confirm that this increase in body mass index correlated with an increase in total visceral adiposity. So we also did Nile red staining in adults to look at the visceral fat depot. And so these are pictures of windowed zebrafish. And you can see that the fetal alcohol fish, when given the high-fat diet, have a very, very large amount of visceral fat. and it's significant when you look at a number of different individuals in this family, that they seem to be storing more fat in the abdominal cavity. This does not exist under normal diet conditions. So in general, our fish do not get fat when they have a restricted diet, and the fetal alcohol fish seem to be having a normal adipocyte content. And so we've also looked at a number of different parameters. We've looked at non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, which we're not going to discuss today, but we also looked at propensity for altered blood glucose homeostasis, and we can do this in zebrafish by essentially removing their tails, centrifuging them, and collecting blood, and then measuring glucose level with just a conventional human meter. And we've done this for multiple different ethanol exposure concentrations to get a sense for the dose response and whether or not more severe alcohol exposure might elicit a more severe phenotype. So under normal diet conditions, we don't observe any difference in fasting blood glucose level. But when we give the high-fat diet, the most severely exposed fetal alcohol fish develop statistically significant increases in fasting blood glucose level, which suggests perhaps a progression towards peripheral insulin resistance or altered glucose handling. So where are we going with our studies? One thing we're really interested in is identifying the metabolic and molecular mechanisms that are causing the rapid progression of our fetal alcohol fish to metabolic syndrome and obesity. And so one of the things that we're focusing on is utilizing RNA-seq and metabolomic approaches in order to figure out exactly how these fish, the fetal alcohol fish, are different from their control siblings. So we've done liver isolation in control and fetal alcohol fish under both diet conditions, and we found a number of very exciting things. So we've identified commonly dysregulated transcripts, meaning transcripts that are significantly altered in both fetal alcohol exposure groups relative to the controls under both diet conditions. And we've been able to show that the fetal alcohol exposed fish are metabolically distinct from their control siblings. And we have a number of metabolic pathways that seem to be altered specifically in the liver in these animals that might lead to this increased disease risk. And we're also simultaneously really interested in the potential that these phenotypes could be passed over multiple generations. And so we're focusing right now intergenerationally to see whether or not the offspring of fetal alcohol fish also have this propensity specifically for obesity. And so we've done our first pilot study. It needs replication and germline-specific outcrosses, but the results were promising in that offspring of fetal alcohol-exposed parents. So in this cross, the mother and the father both had fetal alcohol exposure. Those fish have a propensity for increased visceral adiposity and increased diet-induced BMI relative to their control cousins. And so this suggests that perhaps there is some sort of lasting multi-generational effect. And so we're thinking about potentially doing RNA sequencing on sperm from these animals for other epigenetic profiling to start to understand what differences might be sent through the germline. So that's what we have for today. Thank you so much for listening, and we'd love to take any questions or hear your feedback.
So thank you very much. This is Ed, and I have a question. All your findings are in the males and not in the females?
Yeah, so we did a pilot study that included females, but we did not see any effects on BMI or blood glucose in our females. It was really specific to males. We're not sure if that's because zebrafish store a lot of eggs in their abdominal cavity, and so sometimes when you give females extra food, they make more eggs, and that might be confounding our results a little bit, but it does seem to have a male bias.
Because I think there's anecdotal evidence is that the obesity that one sees at puberty occurs more frequently in the females than in the males.
In the females, yeah, exactly. So I think...
No, I was just going to say, except that those females, the humans, don't store eggs that way.
Yeah.
You know, we may be seeing a second biological difference that masks the effect. So I think it remains to be seen. I guess I would speculate that some of the metabolic effects that we're seeing in adults in this model may not have to do with obesity per se. And there may be changes in metabolism and changes in metabolism that are secondary to weight gain or adiposity, and I think that needs to be separated out.
And I think the findings on the liver are exciting because while the human literature, there's not a lot of studies, I know several cases of very early onset liver cancers and liver disorders. But, I mean, the one review that I think Larry Bird did, you know, he didn't show any, there wasn't any mention or very much mention of liver disorder or problems. But I just think that's just because there were lack of cases. So I'm excited about those data, absolutely.
Hi, it's Joanne. I think the data really are very exciting. And I would urge you to continue to look at sex differences, because just because you don't see a difference in one particular measure doesn't mean you won't see differences in other measures. And as you go on, I think it's important to look at both sexes. There are lots of animal studies in the literature that report sex differences.
Yeah, and I think there's been some interesting studies on potentially females with fetal alcohol exposure, at least in mice, might have a greater propensity for liver disease. So we're going to go back and focus on the liver in the context of male versus female to see what differences we can resolve there as well.
Yes, and if you look at metabolic hormones, there are effects in females too. So I think don't give up on the sex differences, because they could be important.
Okay, thank you very much.
This is Claire. Can I ask a question? Were the fish, the alcohol-exposed fish, smaller at birth?
So our fish are initially smaller, but they recovered to normal size within about 10 days post-fertilization. So it seems like there's some compensatory growth that does happen, and we feed our fish pretty aggressively on the nursery, so perhaps that extra nutrient infusion is helping them to recover. But zebrafish grow throughout their entire lives, sort of in proportion to the amount of food that you give them, and so that may be just sort of an anomaly of the fish model that you might not see in a growth-restricted animal.
Well, there's a whole lot of literature showing that humans with low birth weight are more predisposed to metabolic syndrome later.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's definitely possible that some of the effects we're seeing are a result of a growth restriction, similar to what's been seen in humans in the mouse model. That's exactly right.
Any other questions?
No, it's just my
Yeah, this is...
Oh, go ahead.
Hi, this is... Okay, this is Scott. Have you looked at the pituitary of your fish?
We have not really looked at the pituitary. We know that it's there. It might be slightly smaller, but we haven't looked at any HPA axis signaling.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because there's evidence from Ed's lab and the mouse work that we do that these early exposures affect the pituitary a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And of course that can have a lot of downstream effects that you might be observing.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah, I think there's actually a lot of interesting zebrafish transgenic models where we can ablate certain cell populations in the pituitary, and we might be able to get at how the pituitary is signaling to affect some of these downstream phenotypes.
It's Michael, and I'll just conclude by saying one of the reasons that I wanted Olivia to present her work is that what we've experienced with Johan's group and now with Johan and Scott's project is that sometimes we get clues from the animal work that that inform what we should be looking at as we develop these human populations, and especially in adults. So we're going to want to keep an eye on this, so if there's something that we hadn't thought of that we should be looking for in some of the adult populations as we develop those registries.
But thank you very much, Olivia and Wolfram, for being available, and we really look forward to following the progress of your work.
Look forward to meeting you in Vancouver.
Nice to meet you.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. We're, I guess, a little bit over time. So rather than go into the announcements, I think we'll go to our next presentation, which is by Peter. Peter, are you all set?
Yeah.
Okay.
Can you see my screen now?
Not yet.
No.
This is Jill real quick. Can everyone access WebEx? I think we're almost at capacity.
There's nothing on the screen yet.
Okay, but everyone was able to log into WebEx? Okay.
Yes.
Here we go.
Yep. What's up? Okay.
Yep.
Okay. So I'm going to update everyone on our recent progress on our project. And just to remind people that there are three elements at the certainly for the next year that we're addressing. We're continuing the work on the face in a sense postnatally in children and adults, and that involves doing automated screening of the face both on 2D images, 2D photographs and 3D. And then there's an overlap between the photography of the face and the analysis and ultrasound, and that's in the second row, which is about fetal and neonatal face analysis. And then the third aspect is where it's pretty well solely on using ultrasound analysis to look at the fetal brain. So I'm just going to give some updates on each of these, although primarily focusing on the face. So just to quickly, some of you will know that we're having a subcontract with a partner in Brighton on the south coast of England with someone called Neil Ayton, who's doing who does a clinic specially for children or babies of mothers who are exposing their unborn children to alcohol and other drugs and things. And that is really the slowest progress of all the sort of things we're doing at the moment. So we're initiating a subcontract. We've ordered the mechanics. They're going to do 3D photographs of the neonate faces. We thought they had ethics approval, but unfortunately it was only for 2D photography, and they've now been forced to reapply to do the 3D. But Alison Noble's been talking to the people in Brighton about doing, in addition, some transfontanelle imaging, ultrasound-wise, of the neonates, looking at corpus callosum. And that overlaps nicely with the brain work. Alison's also been in touch with Tina about the appropriate protocol for ultrasound in the Ukraine. So that's really been a bit slow, and I'm hoping we're going to have some progress in a month or two on that. On the fetal brain, this has been held up because the person we want to work on the project, who's currently a doctoral student of Alison Noble's, Ruben Huang, she needs to get a visa because she's a Chinese citizen, and that's still being processed. But I'm not too worried about this because she's writing up her doctorate, and that really is doing work she would be doing on the project anyway. So some of you will know that she's already looking at detecting brain structures automatically using some very, very fancy machine learning methods where she uses the 3D ultrasound to extract bounding boxes for things like corpus callosum and other brain structures. And then once they are identified, then she'll be looking in more detailed analysis. In parallel, she's doing 2D work as well. So she will be addressing 2D ultrasound as well, obviously, likely with the Ukraine images from Tina. So I just wanted to update you on a little bit of work. We shouldn't actually be working on the 2D photos until about January next year, but some ideas have come forward. And so in parallel with the 3D work and other things, Mike's recent face brain paper, which some of you will have received in the last few days, we've been putting together our approach for analyzing 2D photos, which, of course, in the past we haven't been doing. We've been doing 3D. So the idea is to use a portrait and a profile 2D pictures in a pair to identify landmarks, facial landmarks on the, for instance, the portrait, which would give you Y and X coordinates of those points, and then use the lateral to get a profile of the face, which, as some of you know, we've already analyzed in 3D, and also other views of those landmarks on the face, which now would be giving you Y and Z coordinates, where Z is the sort of depth into the face. And then linking that with the 3D face, you can see how you can make that link between the points on the two 2D pictures, the lateral and the portrait, and link them to a 3D shape. And in fact, this 3D shape of the profile, as some of you will remember, has proved to be very, very good at doing discrimination between controls and children with an FAS diagnosis. And I've tested this shape, just this thin black line down the middle of the face, with just 7 landmarks, just 6 on the midline profile and 1 on the outer extremity of the eye. And it's accurate at 0.937 on a scale of 0 to 1 in that fast control discrimination. So it's very accurate. So I'm very hopeful about this. What we need now to do is to work out how to map some of the features of the camera. You know, we have to model the cameras like a pinhole camera and work out the how our 3D coordinates might be altered by the fact that we're using 2D to model 3D. So I just wanted to finish off with showing this video of where we are on the 3D automation. So what you can see is the back of Mike's head. And on the back of my office door, you can see we've attached the Bellus camera. Well, actually, it's a tablet with a little lighting addition. And I'm just going to play this. We tested this earlier, and it seemed to be okay, but it might just be a little bit clunky. You may also hear some sound where the person taking, like, a 3D selfie is told to look in different directions. So you have to keep your face within the green shape on the screen, and then it tells you to turn to the left, and then to the right, and then to the center. So that's the capture of the image. And then Mike is just entering in some ID information. And actually, the way this is set up, you also enter, at the moment, an email address, but that doesn't really matter. And once he hits the button, you'll see that the generation of the 3D image is pretty quick. So there's the image. So I'm filming this with my iPhone over his shoulder, so it's not huge quality, it's usually good quality. But you can see it's a reasonably good 3D image. Although once you see the surface, you can see that it's still not generating quite enough points to give us the detail we would really like. But what the nice thing that Mike has done really nicely is that he's made a wireless link between this tablet and our face screen software running on a laptop. So the image is automatically sent somewhere where our software can just, at the tap of a key, pull up the 3D face that is captured. You notice, you probably will notice that it's also got some landmarks. And then on the right here, again for free, we're just showing the curvature of the face. Blue meaning where it's curved outwards, red where it's curved inwards. So you can immediately perhaps get some impression of the curvature of the philtrum. So you can see a little red patch here, showing, you know, the groove in Mike's philtrum. Although, as I say, it's not quite in the detail we would like at the moment because it hasn't got sufficient points. And then using the landmarks.
Peter,
yeah?
Peter, how does this camera compare to the 3D camera that you and Mike have been using in terms of resolution or detail? In terms of detail? I mean, that was amazing.
You mean the handheld?
Yeah.
Remember, the handheld camera, no, it's not as good yet as the handheld camera. So the handheld camera captures, say, 30,000 points on a man's face, whereas this probably is more like 10 to 15,000.
So, Peter, is 10 to 15,000 good enough for this a first pass screen?
Well, you can see what it's producing, but I don't think it will capture the subtle cases. It will probably capture the fairly obvious ones, but I'm not sure it would be, at the moment it's good enough for the subtle ones. But the company have said they're going to release the camera this autumn on a mass scale at $500. It works on a smartphone as well as on a tablet. Probably it's better on a tablet. I think it's quicker from what Mike's told me. And I suspect what will happen is that, you know, in the next 6 months to a year, they'll increase the ability for the camera to capture more points. Now, of course, as you know, Apple have released the iPhone 8 and the iPhone 10, which have got face recognition in them, and they're obviously capturing 3D data. But I haven't seen any apps, for instance, for sale, which are showing that other people are using the data it's captured. And it's, the question is whether they're just going to, for the moment, use that data for, you know, for the security aspect of using the phone, getting access to the phone. But I suspect they too will make, you know, they'll release the detailed information. For instance, you know, Bellis let us get hold of the data for the landmarks, so we can, Mike actually uses the, you know, the raw data himself. So the next stage would be to, for instance, get a better idea of the curvature by using the landmark information. So you can also, by switching the views, you can get the idea of, if you just look at the filtrum, you know, for instance, if you view the filtrum as like a ski jump, this tells you the curl type curvature. And then on the right, this is the vertical kind of curvature. So this will tell you, it will emphasize the filtral pillars, you know, which on a smooth upper lip, you know, wouldn't show as strongly as this. So you're getting visualizations here, but, perhaps it's not good enough at the moment to do the more quantitative classification analysis that we do. What you can also do, of course, is because it generates the landmarks, you can just, again, by pressing a button, measure the palpal fissure width, and then built into our screening software, you can be put on this set of scores. And Mike, as you can see, is perfectly normal in his PFL length. I don't know whether he fixed that, actually, but anyway. Now, the next stage would be to actually compare the face with one of our models that would be already built into the software. So Mike is going to the only English FASD clinic next week, which is run by Raja Mukherjee, and he's got our software. But he's using the handheld camera from Canfield, not this one. And he's going to reinstall a new version of the software for Raj to test. And that one will actually be able to compare an individual against the model and show a classification, you know, on a spectrum from FAS to control for either the whole face or parts of the face. So that's where we are at the moment.
Peter, this is Ed. I have a question. To test the Bellis camera, can you take the Canfield images and reduce their resolution down to about 15,000 points?
Yeah, we could
and
do
then,
that.
And then see how well that predicts versus when you have 30,000 points.
Yeah, that's a great idea, actually. We could try that.
And,
yeah, we could
I mean, because $500 versus $10,000 makes it available to almost everyone or versus specialized clinics. So that might be a simple test to do it.
Yeah. No, I think that's something we should do.
Peter, this is Ken. a specific question. Do you measure the palpebral fissure length off the 2D image?
At the moment, we would do, but we haven't done that at the moment. What we're doing at the moment is seeing how we can get the 2D into 3D.
So what I'm saying is when Mike's palpebral fissure length was completely normal, was that being done off a 2D camera or a 3D camera?
3D.
3D, okay.
3D camera, yeah.
Okay.
How does facial hair affect the philtrum measurement?
Well, of course, if you really did have a moustache, you wouldn't be able to see the philtrum, and it would really affect it. Mike's just got the fashionable beard at the moment, so there's no problem. I think really I wouldn't say no problem, but there's not much of a problem.
Peter, how long does it take to stitch together those two 2D photographs? Give you that 3D contour.
So, I'm not sure what you're asking. Sorry, can you say again?
So in the middle of your talk, you had shown a slide where you took the two photographs, yes, that one, and had done some of the landmarking, and then got the 3D coordinates. I'm just wondering from how long something like that takes per photograph. Or per subject.
We haven't tested it yet. I mean, this is we're just thinking about the mathematical model to do it.
Okay.
So we haven't actually tested it. But it will be quick. If the question is how quickly you can get the landmarks on the 2D, because then the calculation of the 3D will be very quick. That will be very, very quick. Question is whether these landmarks are done manually or whether they're done automatically. I mean, we were just talking today, and I think it will be possible to use a lot of the techniques that people use for 2D sort of facial recognition work to generate these landmarks semi-automatically, automatically a first version, but you may have to just titivate them a bit yourself to get them in the right place.
I mean, the reason why I ask is the PASS network and Amy Elliott's work, they've got many 2D photographs of kids, and Dale and I were just talking, I don't know if they have the profile pictures like you have to where they could put those together. But I know that's something they're interested in working on.
Well, that's really good to know that, because one of the things we are concerned about is that we don't have many 2D pictures to test this on.
Okay.
So these 2D pictures of Mike, I actually generated by flattening the 3D slightly artificially.
Okay.
So we'd really like that. We
okay.
Really like
well,
2D pictures.
All right. Well, we'll put you in touch with Amy then. I just don't know how many she has from the profile, but it would probably be worth a conversation.
Okay.
Peter, this is Claire. I have a lot of 2D pictures of people who are alcohol exposed, and I know their exposure, and they're 22 years old approximately, and they are both full front and profile.
Oh, brilliant. Well, that's excellent to know. How about controls, though? Any controls?
There are controls as well.
Oh, that's fantastic. Well, we'll have to be in touch with you about that.
Okay. Yeah, they're all African-American.
Well, that's fine, as long as we've got, comparable controls. That's the important thing. It's eerily quiet.
So, Peter, this is Bill Barnett. Do you think that this could be ultimately moved into an app that you could use as kind of a self-screener. You know, we're doing that kind of general registry, volunteer registry. Could this potentially in the future be a component of that?
That's well, if you remember, in our proposal submission, we said we would tackle 2D in two ways. One way, could we exploit the data we've got on 3D by bringing 2D into 3D? And then the other way is to use the methods that my colleague Chris uses to just use 2D in their own right. This we're just thinking about the first way at the moment, but it would be appropriate to use it, yes, for your stuff, doing it online. As long as you could perhaps get a profile as well as the portrait.
Right, I was thinking more kind of the app approach that you showed right at the beginning. And it would be something, and this is not something we're doing with the register right now. People are just volunteering demographic information for the most part, but this could be something that could provide a little bit more, you know, potential screening diagnostics for people who are volunteering to participate, and that might be helpful.
Yeah.
Peter, isn't it also part of the web portal? Or proposed to be part of the web portal?
Yes, it is. That's why we're tackling the 2D. It was for the web portal. But also, like I said, we haven't planned really to tackle this until January, but some ideas came up, and we thought it was worth just putting them down on paper and testing them out.
Mm.
And actually, it's good that we've done this, because already, you know, Claire and others are telling us they've got the data. So we might as well be using that to test some of these ideas. I think we've moved on very quickly. Well, Mike, I should say, you know, he's done all the hard work. Has moved on very quickly with the Pelos camera. You know, that's shown the potential of doing this sort of thing very quickly if you've got the right kind of camera.
This is Ed. Unless there are any more questions, I'll move on. I mean, I think that, you know, and I've talked with Peter about this Pelos camera, and he was kind enough to provide me some slides for the talk at ESPRA. And I think it's, you know, something that really has a lot of applicability and could be put into the field rather rapidly, you know, if it works. And that's the big question now. But, you know, I think the price of that camera will even come down. I think at one time they were talking about $200. So I guess we'll just have to wait and see. All right. Thank you very much, Peter. And we can move on. We've got about 15 minutes left here. And Sarah, could you bring us up to date on the data access committee? And what's going on? I know Tatiana's not on, but...
Okay. Bill Barnett's on. He's the chair of the committee, but I'm happy to cover it if you would like me.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
That's okay. You want me to... Bill can chime in. We have met a couple times. We did have an external request for data, and the committee is it's our first request, so on one hand excited about it, but on the other hand trying to make sure our procedures are in place so that we are consistent from presuming that we're going to get more proposals. And we've had a couple calls, and we're trying to schedule another one.
All right. Bill, I'm sorry. I was just talking with Sarah about this morning. That's why her name popped up.
No worries.
I think it's something that we have to move forward on and try to resolve, you know, as soon as we possibly can.
Right.
Bill Dunty, have any comment on that?
Well, I think it would be good to resolve quickly, but it's probably better to do it the right way. And so probably a good thing to get the input of all the members on the committee. But I think the calls that we have had and the emails we've had have been productive.
So this is Bill. I kind of working on two things, and tactically one is this kind of review checklist, which is where I think we're going to manifest this more formal review process to make sure that we're covering all our bases and we all agree on what's required for a request and that those things are in place. And the second component is, is kind of finalizing getting the phase two data available for sharing. So those are the two things we're working on.
Okay. And Bill Dale and I, with the help of Jill, are in the process of reviewing the drafts for how we would track progress in this next phase. And we're going to be talking about that on Friday. So if anyone has any additions or recommendations, please get them to Jill as soon as possible. We haven't received them from everybody, but hopefully we can start making some recommendations about how to keep track of where we are. I know that a number of people have sent in potential symposia and abstracts for the various meetings that are coming along for RSA, ISBRA, and the European meeting. Michael has been kind of handling a lot of that. Michael, you have any comments? Or?
So I know that Johan and Scott were thinking of something mechanistic, and if you could get that to me soon. For RSA, the deadline is early December, so please try to get abstracts to me. I've had just a couple so far, and as soon as I have enough to form mm-hmm. into a coherent narrative, we'll come up with some symposia ideas for RSA. ISBRA, I think it's January, is that right?
ISBRA? Yeah, the deadline and, will be sometime late January probably.
Right, and we have a couple of ideas for that one, and I think we're all set for Vancouver. Which European meeting were you thinking of, Ed?
It's the European FASD meeting. It's going to be in Berlin, September 24th.
Okay. I don't have a deadline for that one.
No, they just announced the meeting date, September 24th through 26th, but they haven't started doing any
okay.
abstracts, and it's with a heavy focus in European collected data. So it would be Peter and Tina.
Yeah. Anyway, getting back to RSA, if people could continue to send me work that may not be ready for prime time now, but will be in June, we can weave that into a story and come up with a symposium. So far, not quite enough.
Okay. Jennifer has been working on updating the web page, and Jen, you have any comments on that?
All the PIs have seen a draft, and there are a few missing bits of information, and just wanted to make sure everybody read through their piece so that it sounded okay and there weren't any errors. So if everybody can send me any edits today, by the end of today, that'd be great, because we're going to start putting that back up on the web.
All right, and then the only other issue we're having is trying to schedule our face-to-face meeting. And it doesn't seem like, with the number of people involved in CFAS, that a date has come up to make this possible to have a one-and-a-half-day meeting. And I think we're going to try to do it in D.C., in Rockville, Bethesda area, and I'd like to get it done sooner rather than later. So if you can go back to the Google poll and try to rearrange your other appointments and schedules to see what we can do for a February-type meeting, early March at the latest. And you know, this is something that we have to do. It's mandated in the RFA. So, you know, it's a day and a half meeting, depending upon where you're coming from. It may add an extra day of travel, but please redo the doodle poll and let's go from there. Jill, any comments on that? Anything where we're close?
Looks like end of January is close, but there are a number of players that are out. It looks like Ken and Tina are not there. I don't know. I've got it up on the screen right now. If you guys want to look through and see where it's thickly green and see if you can move your reds to green, you just have to go over to your name, like I'm on Claire's name right now, and just click that little pencil, and then it'll open it back up so you can change things. So that's how you would do it.
All right, because we have to do it. We are obligated by the RFA to do this. I think the, I'd like to do it far enough away from RSA so that when we have our informal meeting or our WebEx meeting, that we're not just so close that nothing new has happened in the interim time period. And I'd like to get people to meet everybody and get an update on everybody's project that everybody can hear. I think there's a lot going on and a lot of new possibilities for collaboration and for data sharing. So please try to update that this week, and we'll try to get something together. And we'll just take our chances with the weather in D.C. Hopefully it'll be a less rainy, snowy year than it was last year. All right. Michael, you have any last-minute comments here?
Nothing, thank you.
Dale, Bill?
Nothing here from Mana Tripway.
Okay. SAB?
I have nothing.
Nothing to add.
Nothing to add.
All right, well, then I have something to add. We still would like to increase the number of members on the SAB, and I've received very few suggestions. So if people could think about that and send me some suggestions, or I will just appoint people who I think are very hard and tough and critical. And then we go
from there. I did that already.
I did pick hard. I have picked hard, critical people. But now I'm talking about getting down to those who are really the tough. You wouldn't want to see who they're going to be. So say we just rip everything to shreds. All right, so please get me names of people who would be helpful in assessing and reviewing and making constructive comments to improve these applications. All right?
Constructive.
All right, any other comments by anybody?
No.
Well, we got through that a lot faster than I thought, so thank you, everybody, and we will talk next month.
Oh, this is Jill. Just a reminder, next week's call is the third Wednesday because of the Thanksgiving holiday, so it's November 15th.
And,
next month's call, not next week.
Yeah, and Bill and Dale, if you could stay on for a second, or Bill, I have a question about an unrelated matter.
Yep.
To CFAS. All right, thanks. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you.
Bye.